Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today we'll be listening to the second half of the Debating the Future debate held between myself and the Canadian bioethicist Margaret Somerville at the University of Toronto, August 29th, 2003. This section, we debate the question, should nanotechnology be banned? The debate was sponsored by Better Humans magazine, and you can buy a CD of this debate at betterhumans.com.
Do we need a moratorium on the development of nanotechnology? Now, I don't know if you've remember seeing the movie The Graduate, but there's a very famous scene where a businessman takes Dustin Hoffman aside and says, I just want to say one word to you, just one word, plastics. Well, if some Hollywood suits want to remake The Graduate, and they probably are right now, they'll have to change plastics to nanotechnology. This is the area that has so much promise to it if everything goes well. Already, we've seen sunscreens, clothing and sporting goods that are using nanotechnology on a more simplistic level. That's not the level that has ethicists worried. Peter Singer, the director of the U of T Joint Center for Bioethics, told me that while he thinks ethicists are getting a handle on a lot of bioethical issues, nanotechnology will be the next great challenge. Nanotechnology opponents, on the other hand, fear it could mean powerful new weapons, or they fear, either by accident or design, nanoprobes will run wild, turning the world and its inhabitants into lifeless matter or gray goo. Environmentalists, including those at Greenpeace, worry about the potential for nanomaterials to have a disastrous effect on human health and the environment. It certainly wouldn't be the first technology to do so. If the history of new technology holds, the reality will turn out to be somewhere in between the utopian view and the nightmare scenario. But let's hear from our experts. James, you first this time.
I did read the recent Greenpeace report, and I urge you to as well. It came out this summer, 72 pages of very calm and very detailed and very well-read review of all of the literature about nanotechnology and artificial intelligence. And Greenpeace concluded, the scientists in European Greenpeace who wrote the report, that although there was not enough attention paid yet to the toxicity and control of nanomaterials, there were enormous environmental promise in nanotechnology, environmental benefits which could be gained from nanotechnology, and that no new laws or regulations were required in order to regulate nanotechnology because our existing industrial laws and agencies were sufficient to regulate nanotech, and that the threat of self-replicating nanobots eating the planet was very much overblown. Now, more extreme critics, which you can definitely find if you go on the web, argue that we should have a moratorium on nanotechnology on the basis of what they call the precautionary principle. Now, it sounds in its mild version that you should know what the risks and benefits of something are quite plausible. But the way it is being applied, the precautionary principle, is actually a Trojan horse for banning technology altogether. It's a Luddite Trojan horse. It basically says, don't do anything, until you'll understand its long-term consequences. And since you can never understand the long-term consequences of everything that you do, then you can't do anything. Now, nanotechnology is in that category of one of the things that we will never understand the long-term consequences of. But we have to weigh the benefits and the risks, and yes, we do need to have some safety regulation of it. But the critics overestimate the threats from nanotechnology radically, which we also see parenthetically in the hysteria over GM food, which has never hurt anyone yet, but people are hysterical about. The critics also underestimate the ability of society to respond to those toxic risks. We are a society that learns. We are not simply a static institution. If something bad happens, we develop the regulatory mechanisms necessary. Critics underestimate the need of society to develop robust nanotechnological prophylaxis. I mean, after 9/11 and the various germ warfare attacks. Again, we haven't found any weapons of mass destruction that my country waged its neo-imperialist war for, and so I'm not going to argue that we need to do it in Iraq, but there will be weapons of mass destruction created with these new technologies, and we do need to have various kinds of prophylaxis, and forbidding ourselves to pursue scientific research in these fields will harm our ability to prepare ourselves for that. Before nanotech even became known to the public, nanotech researchers were working on preparing ways of safe design for nanorobotics. For instance, making nanorobots that could only reproduce in certain media or only with the broadcast information from an external source. Critics radically underestimate the ecological benefits and the medical benefits that can be had from nanotechnology. Even to the point, you know, you could say, if nanotechnology were to eat the planet, that risk is so great that we should, that is one kind of risk, a qualitatively different risk that we should not allow nanotechnology because of. But we also face existential risks from things like asteroids and earthquakes and so forth. And I urge you to read Doug Mulhall's book on nanoecology, where he argues that it's precisely technologies like nanoecology which may allow us to bioremediate the damage we've already done to nature and to prepare for the possible extinction of the human race from the natural threats that we face. So I would argue that nanotechnology is a technology like every other, except that we need to have this technology and many others in order to improve our own bodies, lives, the quality of our lives, to protect the planet, to get off the planet and lessen the ecological load that we impose on it for that reason. And I look forward to a nanotech future.
Well, James and I won't disagree on this one nearly as much as we did on the last one, although I must admit he's a very convincing techno-utopian. I mean, that was a great sort of plug for the nanotech. The question that I ask always first is it inherently wrong to do this? And no, unlike human cloning, developing and using nanotechnology is not inherently wrong, which means that its ethical acceptability depends on weighing the risks, harms, and benefits. Now, some of the problems are in the decision-making about those risks, harms, and benefits. For instance, who decides on risks and harms? And certainly it should not just be scientists, and it should not just be industry, which is largely what has happened up until now. The second thing is, on what basis should you make those assessments? The third thing, using which process? Process in making those kind of risk assessments and decisions is not neutral. There's an old saying in law that form is no mere formality. The kind of form you use can very often determine the outcome of your decision-making. And in these kinds of very difficult issues that are going to affect everybody, and where you could really argue that this is a global-scale research project that puts everybody at some potential risk, even if we're justified in running that risk, normally with medical experimentation, you have to get the consent of the people who are placed at risk. So how do we consult the public? And what does getting the consent of the public to these sorts of risks mean? The other problem, and it's one really that James has alluded to, is that benefits and risks are very closely linked with this technology. That it's true that it could help the poor and raise the standard of living around the world, but at the same time it could undermine economies with producing very cheap products on the spot. Now, what sort of principle should we use then to decide which of those benefits and risks we'll take? What I would suggest to you is that we must act according to an ethical principle that's called a preference in favor of the most vulnerable people. So if, in fact, we're going to put at risk people in developing countries, we have to give that risk much more weight than the benefits to us. The risks are not just physical. They're economic, social, moral, and ethical. And, as James has said to you, they're incalculable. So that means that we have to decide, when we've got great uncertainty, what kind of approach do we take? Now, what matters there in conditions of great uncertainty, one of the most important things is the basic presumption from which you work. And there are four basic presumptions for any decision making. Yes, let's do it. No restrictions. So we're not going to have that for nanotechnology. I don't think anybody thinks we should have that. Yes, but, which means you can do it until you find there are some risks. That's actually what's called the precautionary approach. Yes, you can do it, but keep watching out, and if you see risks, you've got to stop. This third one is no unless. Now, that might sound similar, but it's not, because that means no, you can't do it until you show it's reasonably safe to do it. And for instance, some European countries in this kind of area have also added to that reasonably safe and in the public interest to do it. Now, that principle is more restrictive than a yes but, and then the final principle is no, you can't do it at all. The precautionary principle is actually a no unless, and the precautionary approach is a yes but. So I think what we've got here is that Dr. Hughes would be taking the precautionary approach, yes but not if it proves too dangerous. I would recommend the no unless, because in cases of great uncertainty, I think the person with the who wants to do something has the burden of proof, and they don't have to show it's absolutely safe. And they don't, as I read in one of the transhumanist articles, have to show it's safe beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a criminal burden of proof. All they have to show is that it seems reasonably safe to do this. And surely that's, we can expect that. We already use that system before we allow drugs to go on the market. We've got a long experience with that. It's what's called a closed legal system. You can't put a drug on the market until you show it's reasonably safe and effective. And I think we should at least use that. I also very strongly disagree with some of my American colleagues who, with whom I've argued on this, that it's acceptable to use marketplace ethics. And what marketplace ethics means is put it out on the market and that good ethical people won't buy unethical products. Therefore, if nanotechnology is unethical, it won't sell. That's a yes with a delayed but. I also think we have to, worry about, that's actually, in fact, if it works at all, seeing we've got advertising contravening what we might normally decide. I also think we have to worry about justice, especially to future generations. We're not going to bear the brunt of this. Future generations will if it goes wrong. We've got to talk about what we call intergenerational justice, and not intergenerational just of present living generations, but future generations. And finally, all matter, living and non-living, originates at the nanoscale. So in actual fact, nanotechnology is the very closest technology to creation, and it can actually be called atom tech. It's really building from non-living into living, even is a possibility with it. So it raises, again, very complex ethical issues, not ones that are insurmountable, but ones that need a lot of thought. We need ethics. We have to embed ethics in science from its inception. It's not an add-on activity after we've done the science, and scientific research itself is not a value-neutral activity. We've got to think about science time, which is very fast, compared with ethics time, which takes a long time, and we need a broad societal understanding and assessment and very heavy public involvement in these decisions. Thank you.
You're listening to Change Surfer Radio, and this is a debate that was held between me, Dr. J, and Margaret Somerville, Canada's leading bioethicist, on August 29th, 2003, at the University of Toronto, sponsored by Better Humans magazine, and the debate can be purchased from Better Humans on CD at betterhumans.com. This is the section of the debate where we were debating the question of whether nanotechnology should be banned or not. And we're coming up on responses and questions.
Thank you. Well, while there was more agreement on this one, I think James may want to rebut a couple of points.
Sure. Just to lay my cards on the table, I think that the regulatory apparatus for the regulation of industrial chemicals around the world, industrial products, is woefully inadequate. Our two countries have some of the strongest, and European countries have some of the strongest in the world. I know that the American case is very much undercut by the Republican Party, by the corporate lobbies, the precisely those interests who are they're meant to regulate. I don't mean to deny that at all, and I do think that we need to strengthen our regulation. There are many, many chemicals released into the environment every year that are not adequately tested for their safety. And for instance, I'm very concerned about the effects on human fertility of estrogen-mimicking chemicals, which are released into the environment. And I don't think that there's anything necessary about being a techno-utopian that makes us want to see the ecology destroyed or our bodies poisoned. However, I do think that the existing regulatory apparatus that we have is adequate to the task if we step up to the plate as democratic societies. And I don't think, as many, many ecologists argue, that we need to stop industrial progress until we have completely improved or revolutionized our ecological regulatory apparatus. And that's, in fact, what Greenpeace concluded as well,
that we need to proceed with this in a precautionary way, but not to ban it altogether. The application of the precautionary principle, as you say, has many different interpretations for many different people, but if you include in it things like the long-term social consequences, as many ecologists who write about it do, then how could you possibly have a, you know, how could I possibly convince you that the long-term consequences of nanotechnology for the poor were going to be positive or negative? And in fact, it doesn't have anything to do with nanotechnology. The long-term consequences of the livelihood of the poor has to do with whether we have robust democratic movements that establish trade unions and social democratic parties and redistributive systems and public education and public health, all the things which are good for the poor. If we do that, then the poor will have access to the kinds of technology that will allow them to provide for themselves. If we don't do that, if they don't have democratic states, as they don't have efficient democratic states throughout Africa, no matter what technology we give them, whether it's a stone axe or nanotechnology, it's not going to help them very much.
I have only a very brief comment to make, and it's actually on James's original presentation. He tried to justify the risks of nanotechnology by saying, look, we could get hit by asteroids, or not, and something else, I've forgotten what the other thing was that you said.
But earthquakes. Anyway,
earthquakes
and
asteroids.
Gamma ray blasts,
okay,
too, every right 250 earthquakes. Million years.
Okay, so we've got all of that.
We're going to be around. So.
But the point is, that's not a valid comparison, and you've got to be very careful of these kind of risk comparisons. Ethically, I don't think it's valid, and the reason is this, that there's an ethical difference between a risk that we face by chance, that just simply comes from a source that we've got no control over, and a risk that other humans have created and we are subject to or we have imposed on us. We don't have the same ethical responsibility for those naturally occurring risks that we have for those that we know we are creating or at risk of creating. And therefore, our moral agency and our moral responsibility is in the second instance. And that's why you can't compare those risks, even though the risks themselves may be similar in their magnitude or kind. They don't come from the same moral source. And I think it's important.
Governments have no responsibility to prepare for natural disasters?
Sure, but that's an interesting thing, because we also have a very different response to avoidance of risk than creation of risk. There's a book, you'll probably know it, it's by Guido Calabresi called Tragic Choices. And one of the hypotheses he puts is, why do we spend millions looking for some rich guy who deliberately took his yacht, his, you know, gazillion dollar yacht out to sea knowing there was going to be a storm, and yet we don't put railway lines over roads, and the cost per life saved with the railway lines is minimal compared with what we spend on the guy who's out at sea. And the reason is that when we can foresee and somebody could be killed and we know who that person is, when we've got an overt threat to the value of life, then we respond to it in a way that we don't when that threat is hidden, as it is in a lot of these cases with natural disasters. So avoidance doesn't get this. In a lot of cases, it should get the same respect, but it doesn't.
Just wanted to make a point. Actually, it was much more about the other debate, but that there is a social shaping of technology that is missing from the discussion, I feel, although I would agree with most of Margaret's point on cloning. And there's a gender issue that is also out of the discussion, especially in the cloning discussion. But the social shaping of technology at the global level is very, very important for us. I come from Latin America, and most of these things are being done, you know, with no controls, both for the first discussion and the second discussion. So the globalization aspect has to be taken, I think, much more into account. And so the question is, if you look only in terms of choices, you know, if you look at things only in terms of choices and not of social groups and social interest groups, it's a bit of a problem, both the first discussion and the second one. And I would like you to comment on that.
Well, let me say, I think, and the World Transhumanist Association is actually on record advocating the need for global regulatory apparatus to address the threats and to be fora for these kinds of discussions. We agree completely with people who argue that matters of importance to the human race need to be discussed and debated by the human race. We disagree what the conclusions of those debates should be, but we agree that there should be such debates and that we should create the mechanisms for them. In terms of whether there should be equity between the first world and the second world in the diffusion of technology, absolutely. I think if the nanotechnology, like any other technology, is monopolized by the first world and used to increase our advantage over the third world, that would be terrible. We saw, for instance, a recent example just last week of a brokered deal to allow South Africa to have access to AIDS drugs, which are very, you know, expensive, not that expensive to produce, but actually expensive because of the patents. And because of this broker deal, South Africans will have access to those drugs. That's not an ideal outcome, but that's the kind of outcome that we can expect increasingly with other kinds of technology diffusion. In terms of the gendered nature of the discussion, I made reference to the fact that the culling of eggs from women is currently unsafe and is one of the grounds on which this technology should not be permitted. I'm not exactly sure what other gendered grounds that one might adduce in the discussion, but I do think that's relevant.
Yes, I think you raised something too that we don't know what to do about at the moment, and that is that with our increasing globalization, I think a lot of us feel more and more individual and alone. And whereas previously we had rather homogeneous communities or perhaps even countries where we could feel we belonged, what our values surveys are showing that especially younger people, people under 25, are not relating within their own physical and geographical boundaries. They're relating on a common values base around the world to other people with shared values. Some of you might know Michael Adams, who heads up Environics Research, and he has what he calls these value tribes, where he tries to put people into these, I think he's got 13 different value groups now, where those people in each of those values tribes share the same kind of values. And what he finds is that you take a young person, a young man in Toronto, is more likely to have a whole lot of other compatriots in other countries around the world and not even have spoken to anybody who lives in the same street as he does. So I think so it's sort of interesting that we're seeing that shift to that shared values at a global level. Yet, I've thought a bit about this and don't really know what to do about it either personally or certainly not at the public policy level. I think it's very hard for us to relate to a global reality without feeling totally overwhelmed and therefore feeling, what can we do about it? And so this idea that we've got a responsibility to the rest of the people on the planet is pretty sort of daunting. And how we can take that in with and have a reaction of hope and do something that will be helpful and positive and not have a despairing and nihilistic reaction, I'm not sure. And certainly what we're seeing among the younger people is that they're becoming more and more and more intensely individualistic. And I wonder if that's not a response to that inability to take in some of the horrors in our world at the moment, and certainly the very basic and fundamental needs of so many people. So I think that's something, what we can do about it, I don't know.
I recently was rereading a document that a whole group of about 50 different leftist academics sent to Lyndon Johnson in 1964, including my mentor political guru, Michael Harrington, American socialist writer. And they said back in 1964 that very soon, and it implied that in the 1970s, there would be massive structural unemployment as a result of industrial automation. And that as a consequence, Lyndon Johnson and the War on Poverty and the Democratic administration should immediately begin to consider the prospect of the need for a basic universal income, which would allow people to live without having any connection to employment. Now, that's something I've long supported, and I think it is, in fact, one of the solutions to the economic dislocating effects that will come from nanotechnology. But I just point to it because there have been many, many instances in socialist history and in futurist history where people have pointed to technologies and said, you know, in 20 years, this technology will cause this widespread dislocation in society, widespread unemployment or whatever, and it just doesn't happen. The industrial working class is 100 years late for the proletarian revolution, so I'm very well aware of that. I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that these changes will happen, as you talk about in ethics time, these will happen in democratic time. We will be able to respond in time sufficiently with adequate public policy if people begin to become homeless and poor and hungry because of these technologies. I think we should have a preferential option for the poor, but I don't see how that has any impact on nanotechnology whatsoever.
Okay. Do you want to come up to the mic?
Well, we could all live longer, happier, healthier, stronger lives with more abilities. Well, again, that's the question of equity, and I think it's right there on the table, but it is not a question of technology. The question of should we have cell phones when half of us can afford them and half of us shouldn't? Yeah, it's unfair that poor people don't have cell phones. Is it so unfair that we want to subsidize cell phones for everybody? No, because really having a cell phone we don't consider a basic right. Having food is a basic right, having housing is a basic right, having clothing is a basic right. And if nanotechnology creates social dislocation, which requires us to remediate it for those basic rights, I think we absolutely should. But the question of how equal we are as a society is the question on the table. When you're concerned about that, it's not whether we should have nanotechnology or not. In the first place, there's no evidence whatsoever that nanotechnology is going to exacerbate inequality, right? Every technology enters a playing field and changes the playing field of social struggle. So some groups will benefit and other groups won't. We don't know which groups are going to benefit. It could be that the third world will use nanotechnology to leapfrog over the United States in the global race. You know, right now jobs are fleeing out of the IT tech sector in the United States to India and other developing countries because of globalization, because of the internet. It's possible to do intellectual labor in the third world that is too expensive to do in the first world. So it's not clear at all who's going to benefit from this.
You've been listening to the second part of a debate between myself, Dr. J, and Margaret Somerville, one of the leading bioethicists of Canada, held at the University of Toronto on August 29th, 2003, sponsored by Better Humans magazine, titled Debating the Future, and available from betterhumans.com. You can hear the first part of this debate at changesurfer.com, and the third part of the debate about human genetic engineering will be broadcast next week. I'm embarrassed to admit that it's taken this long, but Dr. J's finally started a blog with some of his friends called Cyborg Democracy. You can find it at cyborgdemocracy.net. And of course, Cyborg Democracy is also the title of my forthcoming book from Westview Press. The blog is, as we title it on the website, a collaborative blog for democratic transhumanists, nanosocialists, revolutionary singularitarians, non-anthropocentric personhood theorists, radical futurists, leftist extropians, bio-utopians, biopunks, socialist feminist cyborgs, transgenders, body modifiers, basic income advocates, world federalists, agents of the culture and the Cassini division, Viridians and Technogaians, all transmitting a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Some of the participants on our blog include Dale Carrico, the San Francisco and postmodern culture critic and author of the Progressive Futures column at betterhumans.com, Justice de Taizier, the Haitian-Canadian who chairs the Montreal Transhumanist Association, George Dvorsky, the chair of the Toronto Transhumanist Association and columnist for betterhumans.com and author of the Sentient Development blog, Robin Green, a socialist transhumanist vegan activist, Carl Janiski, a left-wing Washington, D.C.-based lawyer, Ken MacLeod, the revolutionary socialist, Scottish science fiction author, and author of the Early Days of a Better Nation blog, Ramez Nam, author of the forthcoming book More Than Human, Julio Prisco, the Spanish editor of the magazine Transhumanity, and Philip Schropshire, editor of the radical Three River Tech Review blog, and finally Charlie Strauss, the very radical and highly acclaimed science fiction author, editor of his own anti-Pope blog. So join us at cyborgdemocracy.net for a daily stream of radical news from a transhumanist perspective. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.